Thank you for joining us on History FM Radio on LiveParanormal.com and History FM. From paranormal to the unexplained history, it all happens here. Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in live interactive chat 24/7 with our radio show hosts and other like-minded people on www.liveparanormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by full interactive media. Stop by now and join in on the fun.
Welcome to Science and the Paranormal with me, Dr. John DeSalvo, and my co-host, Lady Veronica. And we are live every Thursday night from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. And I want to thank you all for joining us. And we've got a really special topic tonight on Joe Parr's pyramid research. And in my 30 years of research on the Great Pyramid, well, maybe 20, 25 years of research on the Great Pyramid of Giza and pyramid research, the most questions I get is about Joe Parr's research, because Joe Parr is considered the modern day Tesla and discovered the energy fields around the pyramids, was able to recreate them. And we're going to be talking about these and his incredible discoveries. He even knows, I'll even talk how we discussed, how we discovered how to measure ley lines. I bet nobody listening knows how to do that. So, I mean, it's just amazing. Joe was doing this research for 40 years before he passed away a few years ago, and he was my best friend. I was a spokesperson, and he was also research director of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, which I'm director, and that's at GizaPyramid.com. GizaPyramid.com. And a lot of Joe's articles and papers are on our website. So make sure you check that out after the show. I'd like to bring on and introduce my co-host, Lady Veronica. Hello, Veronica. How you doing tonight?
Great. Glad to be here. This will be an exciting show, I think.
Yeah, I think you're going to like it, because, you know, Veronica is a biomedical engineer for a large pharmaceutical company, and she's brilliant. And the other thing, you know, I keep telling her, and I hope, keep interrupting me when I say something you're not sure or a term you're not, you know, a lot of people,
yeah.
A good host, a good radio host, always interrupts the guests. I know it sounds rude, but when you listen to TV or radio, you'll see they always do this, because when someone just goes on with a monologue, it gets boring and people miss, mm-hmm. You know, I throw terms out, and what you're good about is you stop me and say, no, wait a minute, you know, what does that mean?
Yeah, well, that's because I know what it means. I'm not just trying to do it for the sake of doing it, you know, but that's why I think it's good that, you know, me being on here, because it's not just that I'm a skeptic. It's that I just don't know a lot of this stuff, and you know, I've been exposed to it, obviously, being related to you. But you know, I don't know all this in-depth stuff that that you know very well. And so once you start getting into those details and a lot of the stuff I've never heard about, I think it's helpful, because a lot of the listeners probably haven't heard these details either.
Exactly, and you know, I think this radio show is unique in that you, as co-host, I'm kind of a believer. I'm a scientist, a biophysicist. I'm a neurophysiologist too, but I'm a believer in the paranormal. I studied it for 30 years, but I'm skeptical. You, in a sense, I mean, I'm not going to try to label you, but more of a non-believer, more of a scientist, and you question everything. So we have that dynamic, like fear and balance, you know, like one political party and the other one. And I think that's good, because, you know, we really don't know for sure a lot of the things we talk about. So what I want to do is maybe give a little boy. I mean, I could do the whole show just talking about who Joe Parr is. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, Joe Parr. Can you hear that beep? I get a call coming in. It's bugging me. No,
I can't hear it.
Do you hear any? Oh, good.
No.
Good. Okay. All right. I just want to make sure it's not interfering with my discussion here. Because you've got Joe Parr. I actually met Joe Parr probably about 20 years ago. How we met, he sent me a letter saying, this is all the stuff I've been working on for the last 30 or 40 years. And he went one thing after another, and every sentence was loaded with, oh, my God, is this true? Is this guy a crackpot? One thing after another. And then I realized, yeah, I'm thinking, no, he knows what he's – a scientist can tell if somebody's BSing or – and he's throwing stuff at me. And then the last sentence he said, I know I'll probably never hear from you, so goodbye because nobody else does.
Wow. That's pretty hilarious.
I used to always joke with him. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, obviously, reach out to him, so it's pretty funny that he really didn't think he would. And, you know, in knowing you as a person, obviously, like, you would never ghost people. You know, you would never not answer someone like that. You would at least answer them and let them know if maybe you're not interested or if you can't help them or anything. So that's kind of funny.
Yeah. Well, in those days I did. Now I don't. I get too many emails. But no, it's true. Well, anyway, I there's something that told me this guy was something special. And I did contact him, and we became the best friends and became research colleagues. We worked together for about 20 years. Again, he died several years ago. And I always said to Joe, if 1/100th of what you've discovered turns out to be true, it could change the world. He really was nicknamed the modern day Tesla. He was just amazing. Now, a little bit about his credentials. That was kind of our friendship, and Joe even laughed at my jokes. So, I mean, that's the other reason I like Joe.
Yeah, now I've had to take on that responsibility. It's a tough job.
Yeah, you got to laugh at my jokes. That's part of the job description. But it was funny to see Joe. We wanted to get his stuff out, and nobody would print it. So he'd send an article into a technical journal, and he would get an editor that he never knew or heard of before. So he thinks he was being censored, and they would block out, you know, like in a redacted version, his special secret discoveries. So that's why I think, too, he was starting to give up, because every time he tried to publish his work in these journals – he would get an editor. He said, I never even heard of this guy. I don't think he even works for the magazine. And then they would totally edit his article into nothing every single time. So he was frustrated. So I guess by the time he must, and I think he came upon my website, you know, the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association website. And he figured, well, what the hell? I might as well write to this guy. And and so that's kind of how we met. Now, a little bit about Joe. Joe was an electronics engineer for over 40 years. And he also invented a device known as a gamma ray transducer. Sounds like something out of a science fiction show, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It doesn't sound real.
Yeah, but what it was is it was a scientific device for measuring levels of radioactivity around different energy sources, some even like paranormal energy sources. So it was a completely new type of device that measured gamma rays from different sources. And, you know, gamma rays are the most powerful rays in the universe, even more than X-rays. They penetrate through everything. And that's important because they're involved in his pyramid research, which we'll be talking about. So Joe was involved in 8 top secret government projects spanning the globe, including being in the Arctic and Antarctica. And he wintered there,
I'm
sure, many
that.
Times. Yeah.
Was he doing there?
I can't tell you that because everything was top secret.
Yeah,
I'm serious.
I thought I could get you there, but I didn't.
he told me some stuff, but anyway. Most of the stuff is declassified, but it was so secret. He said there was a B-52 bomber flying above the lab or with the facilities 24 hours a day. And I said to Joe, oh, that was good. You had protection. He said, no, that was the blow us up if anything got out, I guess.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. I was like, what purpose would that serve other than blowing up the place?
Yeah, I don't know if he was serious. I think he was serious, or, you know, maybe that was his speculation, but I never forgot that. I'm thinking, yeah, that's kind of weird, you know. That's really a top secret project, you know. He got mad at me once because I was on the radio and I mentioned the places he did the research and they were all top secret. And he said, no, you can't mention that. If you mention top secret, you can't mention a location. Or if you mention a location, you can't mention top secret. So I don't know. So anyway, but he was the real
clearly
deal.
Clearly he's never been
me.
A part of a top secret mission.
Who?
You, if you don't know the rules about top secret.
Well, okay, but I will skip
dumb.
That. I'll skip this. We'll move on here. Okay, so. Well, one thing, never mind. I better not say anything. I'm going to get in trouble. But anyway, so now Joe also was interested in pyramid research for some reason. You know, who knows why? Why all the crazy things am I interested in? But Joe was a scientist, an engineer like me, and he actually is one of the few people to have spent, you ready for this, Ronica, two separate nights on the Great Pyramid, on the top of the Great Pyramid of Giza, conducting electrical, magnetic, and radioactive measurements.
Oh, wow. Wait, so he, like, camped out for two nights in a row
yeah.
on the pyramid? That's awesome.
No, one night in 1977. And another night in 1987, 10 years apart.
Oh, wow.
He bribed the guards to climb and go up there, of course.
Yeah, I was going like,
yeah,
to yeah. Like, what's like the standard? Like if you go there as a tourist, you can just look at it. You're not allowed to climb it?
Oh, no, because people have died and have fallen off it and it's dangerous. And, you know,
so
but
he, did he climb the outside?
Yeah. Yeah. Because they're
wow.
blocks, you know, and you can climb up. And he climbed all the way up to the top. And I got a picture, actually. Unfortunately, this Barnes & Noble's book is out of print, you know. Do I have a picture in this
yeah.
book? I know it's got, I got one on the website. Let me see here.
So
but I got a beautiful picture of him.
Picture,
how yeah,
high
there it is.
Is oh, okay. I know I should probably know
high
this,
is a great
but
pyramid.
How,
oh,
yeah,
God.
How high is it?
584, I think. Oh, God. It'll come to me. You gotta, you know, the simplest questions you never can remember, you know?
Yeah,
So,
but
I was gonna say, I can look it up.
Do you know how long it took him to climb it? Did he tell you?
It's a good question. You know, I don't know. 454 feet. That was pretty close, huh?
Hmm.
It's
yeah.
equivalent to a modern 50-story building. There are 203 courses that he had, or steps to the summit. So, I think. Most people, I think people tell me it takes an hour or two, but I, you know,
I believe that.
I
mean, I
don't know.
A 50-story building, if you're climbing the stairs, this will take much longer because you're, like, not climbing stairs, but it makes sense.
Yeah, hell, I'd hire a helicopter and have me drop me there, you know. but I guess you couldn't do that. So I said to Joe, isn't it windy? It was windy up there, right, and cold? He said, yeah. So we'll stay in all night. What did you do? He said, like, I brought those big garbage bags, and I slept in those or wrapped those around me.
Yeah, because the desert gets really cold at night, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And can you imagine being up there too with the wind and stuff,
yeah,
depending on the time of year. So, but he had, and also he had to lug up all that equipment. I'm not sure if he hired somebody to help him bring it up. I'm guessing. I think he did that. Okay. That he hired because he had, you know, we're talking about really sophisticated. So this guy was an engineer, right? He wasn't a crackpot pseudoscientist, you know,
right.
with a ghost box or something. Well, that's a different story. I don't mean to put down ghost box, but I mean these are real hardcore engineering devices. Mm-hmm. He's measuring radioactivity, electrical measurements, but you know,
right.
I mean,
he's actually analyzing
all kinds of stuff.
Hard data. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So. And by the way, Joe was one of the first person to privately, not with NASA, he was the first private individual to bounce a signal off the moon with a laser. Because remember three of the Apollo missions.
Cool.
Yeah. Remember, there was a Big Bang episode. You remember they were doing that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The TV show?
I remember that one. That is
Sheldon
cool.
Sheldon and
like, they. Yeah.
Yeah, and
Penny's. Like, I don't remember.
Yeah,
Penny did what?
Penny was her stupid boyfriend. Said, "What are you guys doing? We're going to bounce a laser off the moon." He goes, "Oh my God, you're going to blow up the moon?" You know.
Oh right. Love that.
So
yeah, it's like
so yeah.
It's funny. It's cool that they like, you know, someone thought of that, like, oh, we should put something on here that you can bounce, that like anyone can like bounce a laser off of to prove that we were actually here.
Well, it wasn't really for that. It was actually the measurement of the moon, knowing how much it would move so they could measure it, you know, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The story behind it, I don't know how much you know, and I don't know how much the public knows, but there were three different Apollo missions that put a plate in a specific different locations. Actually, the last mission was Apollo 15, and my good friend who passed away, God, all my friends have been passing away, is Colonel Jim Irwin, who walked on the moon. We were doing a secret project together. But Jim's Apollo 15 was the last Apollo mission to put a reflecting plate on the moon. That's when people say we never went to the moon. I say, okay, there's three different coordinates that NASA can give you. If you shine the laser up, it'll come back. Any other place on the moon, it won't. Who put those there? Aliens and gave us the coordinates? I mean, right? I mean, that's pretty good proof we went to the moon.
Yeah, do you think there's people that think we didn't go to the moon, but aliens put those on the moon?
I think they don't know about those plates, or if they do, they're kind of in a conundrum trying to explain it.
That's
okay.
True. Or they just, they're not looking at the facts. Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever anybody posts something about that, about not going to the moon, I always post, and I post that, and you can look up the coordinates. But so, I mean, it's not a secret thing. So, but anyway, but Joe was the first private person to do that. He was involved in developing polyphasic communications and something to do with
that?
Juan Perón. I can't get into that too much, but polyphasic communication, it was one of the most secret types of communication systems that he developed with a doctor. I'm going to call the guy Dr. V. And after it was developed, they tried to take Dr. V out because they didn't want anyone else to know how to do it. And Juan Perón actually, that's the way the story goes, distrusted anybody who knew about it. So ordered his men to take Dr. V out. But he got away. But Joe was involved in that also. I mean, the guy's brilliant, right? He's been involved in everything. But he also got a law degree, but he never practiced. He just was curious, so he went and got a law degree. So, I mean, amazing guy. So, yeah. And then I also made him director of our Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association. I'm going to throw this in real quick, too. He also discovered, because I know people want to know this, he's one of the first to discover how to measure ley lines. You know what ley lines are? They're supposedly energy lines between, like, ancient monuments and megaliths and somehow there's a grid on the earth, you know, and that the ancients could psychically sense this grid, and where they cross, they sometimes built monuments. It's theoretical. No one knows for sure. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you heard of those?
No,
ley lines,
no, I actually haven't. I'm glad you explained it before I had to ask.
Yeah. Oh, you're too slow. You should have jumped on me. Little ley lines. Anyway. Joe figured out that they're like electromagnetic radiation or waves, and the only way to measure them is if you move through them. So he got like a big Helmholtz coil, an amplifier, audio amplifier, and whatever. He mounted it on his truck and used to drive through areas at high speeds where allegedly ley lines were, and was able to actually measure them. You know, like in a magnetic field, the thing sometimes you can't measure it unless you move through it, you know? You know that, like if you have a wire and you move it through a magnetic field, you have a current, right? And if you put a current through a wire, you develop a magnetic field around the wire. So it's one of those things where you have to be kind of moving to measure it. So now this wasn't done worldwide. He just did some preliminary work with this. And so if somebody could follow up on that, I mean, can you imagine if you could get a device that you go around the world and actually measure the ley lines and one, see if it's true, and actually get an adequate map, you know?
Yeah, so he found that he did, like, encounter proof of some of these ley lines, at least.
Yeah, he did. So, it according to his preliminary results, and I have to say that, he believes that ley lines do exist, and they do run through monuments. Now, here's the question. Yeah. How did the ancients know this? Was it a psychic thing?
But actually, you're kind of beating me to my question, which is kind of like, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? So is it that the monuments are built on these ley lines, or that the monuments themselves create them once they build them? You know what I mean?
Yeah, we think alike, because I thought, also thought that too. Maybe the monuments are the energy sources that then created it. You're very smart. Yeah, the chicken, which came first, the chicken or the egg? That's very interesting.
We don't necessarily know, because it's not like anyone knows what the ley line data was before the monuments, because they're all, so old.
Right. Exactly. So, and that's a really good question. And supposedly there's higher radioactivity levels around megalithic structures, even like inside the Great Pyramid. I was not involved in that research, or Joe wasn't, but on the top he was measuring it. But so there's some investigators out there that measured radioactivity at many of these monuments and said that the level at the monuments were higher than the background radiation. And I didn't look at the original data, but what this seemed to show is that there is something to that, which, again, that maybe were the ancients psychic that they could feel radiation? Is there a receptor for it that we have lost, or somebody developed? I don't know. Very interesting question. So Joe decided to do some research on the pyramid. And what he wanted to do is his assumption. Well, he found out that strange phenomena happens because of the shape of the pyramid, okay? If you do these same experiments in like cubes, octagons, spheres, you don't get energy fields developing, okay? So what basically happened is that he believed there's an energy field around, like a bubble, he called an orb, okay, around the Great Pyramid of Giza and any structure that's a pyramid shape, okay?
Okay.
Before I tell you how he measured it, but he found out that it's only because he measured the stuff at Giza too. He realized it was mostly at a very low level and not enough he could experiment with. So he did some experiments and developed a system where if you put a model pyramid in a centrifuge, and you know what a centrifuge obviously is, you work for biomedical engineer, something that spins around, whatever. To sediment the test tubes. But if you put a model pyramid in a centrifuge, spin it at a high velocity rotation in an electrical magnetic field, alternating current, you can enhance the energy field around the pyramid that you can actually measure it as an energy field. And he had his devices to measure it.
So did he theorize why the high speed would make a difference?
No, that's a good question. What he was kind of doing, it's almost like the Russians. How did they pick the angle? They did some experiments and prototypes.
Remember
right, we talked
yeah,
about that
I guess
last just, week.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if maybe if he had the theory and then was like, let me try the centrifuge, or if he just kind of was trying a bunch of different things.
Yeah, no, it was kind of trial and error. So what he found out was that when he sped the pyramid in this electromagnetic field in the centrifuge, a bubble or orb developed around it that was able to block out a lot of type of electromagnetic energy, even radio waves. Okay. It was like a shield that all pyramids, the shape of the pyramid produces an energy field around it that can be enhanced and actually act as a protective shield, okay?
Okay. So just for clarification, so he found that these things were true as the pyramid was spinning in the centrifuge?
It wasn't like
he spun it in the centrifuge and then after he tested these things?
No, it was spun around the centrifuge. It was spun around about 1,800 RPMs. To a magnetic field.
And he was doing these measurements while it was spinning?
In the lab, right.
Okay.
And he was able to put sources in the pyramid, his model pyramid, like radioactive sources, radio frequencies, different things things that gave off different kinds of radiation, and then measure the attenuation, that is the blocking of these energy fields. Okay?
Okay. I see now. I
like
was
if
confused
you go in,
as to how he was measuring this.
Yeah. If you take like a radioactive source and you go into a lead vault and close it, the
right.
lead vault blocks it. This orb acted like a device that blocks off all known electromagnetic radiation. Now, even gamma rays.
That's
which
pretty
is a
crazy.
Stronger, yeah. Gamma rays pass right through the Earth. They're most potent, strongest. In fact, a lot of people think the extinction of the dinosaurs was through the burst of a gamma ray, you know, supernova, whatever. So, you know, we're talking about an orb, an energy field, a shield that's very strong. So how did he measure it? He measured it by the attenuation. That's the blocking of these energy fields. Plus, he noticed a drop in pressure, which he measured with a special gauge. So very, very scientific, very sophisticated, the first of its kind. And so the funny, interesting thing was the energy field around the pyramid. You ready for this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He started his work in 1979. And then the energy field in December of that year stopped working. The energy in the pyramids disappeared. And then they started again.
Of which pyramids?
The ones in his lab that he was experimenting with.
Okay.
And then in 1983, they started to develop again. And there was a whole certain times the energy fields were present around the pyramid and he could enhance it. And other times he couldn't.
Interesting.
And
so
it
that,
wasn't.
So this was the energy field when the pyramid was not in the centrifuge or when it was?
No, when it was.
So he would do these experiments regularly, and at certain times, the energy field was greater than other times.
Exactly. And what he found out, so he had this whole 20 years of data, okay? We're talking about 20 years of data that showed certain times of the year, the pyramid developed a strong bubble to protect it. At other times, it was almost zero. And he had no idea why.
And there was he couldn't find any pattern?
No pattern. Until he saw an article.
I knew that was coming.
that NASA published and said, using weather balloons, we have been measuring a gamma ray emitter in the center of our galaxy.
Huh.
Which varies with time. Now, they don't know, even to this day, we don't know what it is. We think it may be two black holes, circulating in the center of the galaxy. But we don't know what it is. But, and guess what? When the gamma rays from the center of the galaxy intensified, the bubble increased. When the gamma ray emitter, it was called the Great Annihilator because they felt gamma rays could annihilate all human and cause human extinction. And so his data for 20 years matched that. And he goes, oh my God.
Wow.
So somehow the pyramids on Earth are monitoring the center of the galaxy. And when the gamma rays increase, the bubble around the pyramids increase. Now, the Great Pyramid of Giza is in Egypt.
Yeah.
And it's on a certain latitude and longitude. Nobody really knows why they built it there. Some people in the 1800s thought that it's like at a latitude about 30 degrees north and what the hell's the longitude? I think 31 degrees east, something like that. But anyway, they thought it was like the center of the landmass, but that didn't make a lot of sense to me. Well, it turned out Joe calculated due to the rotation of the Earth, the center of the galaxy, because that of that location, that's the only location at that latitude that once a day, the base of the pyramid would point to the center of the galaxy where the gamma ray emitters are.
That's crazy. That's the only place?
It would point to other places, but if you built the pyramid in a different location, it would not point to the center of a galaxy
that's what I
once
meant. So,
a day.
So that place is the only place they could have built the pyramid to have it point there. So the other pyramids next to the Great Pyramid don't point there.
Yeah, I think if you're close to the 30-degree latitude, it may. That was the key, but especially where the Great Pyramid was, it was exactly. Now, and I can get into science fiction now. There was actually a Star Trek episode on this, but was the Great Pyramid built by some civilization or whoever to be like a doomsday protection device that if gamma rays, which can extinguish all life, were emitted, the pyramids would produce an energy field protecting anyone within its vicinities? Speculation.
Well, based on Jopar's research and you say he's shown, it makes sense if that were the case.
It's interesting. It gets even better. Certain times of the year, the pyramid would fly off the centrifuge, just break off and fly into the wall and become embedded in the wall like it was going to hyperspace, like a science fiction movie.
It's not like it would hit the wall and then like part of it would crash. It's like it would go through it and still be a full structure.
Yeah, it would be embedded in it like it was passing through its molecules, but didn't go through the wall, just got embedded in it in many cases. And this happened
at
the same time every year.
Was he able to pull it out, or was it just stuck in the wall? Did it
I don't know.
Break off?
I think he broke it off because, actually.
So he
be
so
a
he
nice
has like
design
pieces
for
of
room.
Pyramid in his. Yeah, he just has pieces of pyramid all in the wall.
Yeah, but the funny thing is, it was always in the same direction and always at the same time of the year in December. It's the only time that happened.
Any theories?
And guess what happens at that time of year?
Oh, what?
The sun gives off neutrinos, right? You know what neutrinos are, right? One of the fundamental particles, right? Similar to the electron, it's the electron is negative, but neutrinos don't have a charge. And they're like three types. I don't want to get into the particle physics, but neutrinos are given off by the sun, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, at that time, the sun is directly lined up with the Earth in the constellation Orion when the main neutrino belt hits the Earth, and that's when the pyramid – the pyramid's bubble completely closes off at that time, and nothing can pass through the orb, not even gamma rays, and there's nothing we know of that can block gamma rays. So the bubble would close off completely. The pyramid would rip off from the arm of the centrifuge, and it went in the direction of where Orion's constellation was at that time in December. Like it was almost some kind of transport device that the neutrino beam from the sun.
So when you say the bubble closed off completely, you mean normally it would be kind of like a half, or like there'd be, it wouldn't be completely sealed. It would just kind of be, there'd be a hole or something.
Yeah,
but
some percentage of attenuation, like 20%, 30, 50, 70, depends on the gamma ray emitter from the center of the galaxy, So, and the centrifuge speed and everything. But then he didn't expect that. All of a sudden, the damn thing closes off and nothing can pass it. But talking about military application right there. Anyway, it would shoot off, and he believed it was trying to move through hyperspace, and maybe it was a way to travel in ancient times. Maybe the pyramids were a device to travel. And don't forget, the shaft of the King's Chamber points towards Orion. I don't know if you knew that or not.
No, I didn't know that. Wow.
Interesting.
The
Southern Air Shaft and the King's Chamber.
Oh. So the you explained a little bit how the small models that Joe Parr was building, he had to put them in the centrifuge because he couldn't get the readings by themselves. But that's just because they were small. So how come the big pyramid?
Well, he did it, worked on the Great Pyramid too. But the whole point of the centrifuge with the pyramids was to intensify the energy field so he could measure it and do experiments.
Oh, okay. So the bigger the pyramid, the bigger the energy field. So he just had to simulate that. Okay.
Yeah. And so there's always this energy around the Great Pyramid. Now, what's funny is the slope of the Great Pyramid, and I'm throwing a lot out there. It's kind of interesting, but it all comes together, doesn't it? I mean, it's almost like there's a field that's going to go around the pyramids to protect it and that area when the gamma rays from the center of the galaxies intensifies, which are harmful to humans. And at certain times of year, the bubble closes off. The pyramid tries to travel towards Orion through hyperspace, which Joe believed.
Okay.
And that's kind of one interesting. Is this something the ancients had knowledge of? You know, a lot of people point to aliens or multidimensional beings. Again, you know, we get into speculation, and I don't want to go there. I just want to talk about the science. Okay?
Right. Yeah.
So, you got to admit that's interesting. Now, if he hits the pyramid, like a Giza or any model pyramid, with sound waves at 51.5 cycles per second or hertz, it increases the energy of the bubble. And guess what? That's the slope of the Great Pyramid, 51.5 degrees.
I was just about to say that because last week we were talking about the Russian pyramids and you said something about hitting them with that, you know, the 71 whatever hertz, and I was like, oh, that must be why. See, I do pay attention.
Isn't that interesting? But I mean, well, the funny thing is when I promoted Joe Parr's work again, Ancient Aliens did a really great segment of me talking about Joe's work, but it's not because of me, but because of Joe's work, and they did great graphics. And that's one, what was that one called? Secrets of the Pyramid. You know, about a half a dozen shows
season,
I was on.
It's season 5, episode 1. I know that.
Yeah,
and
if
the
listeners
the
can pull that up. It was really. In fact, a lot of people said they thought that was one of the best Ancient Alien shows. They repeat that one a lot, by the way. And again, it's not me, it's Joe's work, but the producers did incredible graphics of Joe's experiments with the spinning pyramid and hyperspace and time, because Joe believed the pyramid had something to do with time travel too. I don't even know if I can get into that. I didn't even publish that, but he thought, you know, like there's hysteresis and electromagnetic objects. There's, I don't want to get into this, but there's something like that with time. And that allowed, he believed that if he could recreate that in the Great Pyramid, he could move back in time through the Great Pyramid.
Hmm.
That hasn't been published, but that's something he was working on before he died.
So that's
incredible
stuff,
isn't it?
Yeah. So he thinks, so the theory of the pyramid traveling and stuff like that, that would mean that if you're inside the pyramid, essentially you would travel through time, but the pyramid would stay there because it's present through all time, right?
As far as I know, nobody's done it, but that's what I'm guessing. I mean, can't imagine the pyramid disappearing, but I'm guessing it affects the time-space matrix in the pyramid. And people who've been in the King's Chamber, you know, experienced, you know, out-of-the-body experiences and all kinds of strange things and visions. And if I was going to give a course in physics, you know, you have low and low frequency and high frequency energy and wavelength. Radio's the short wave, and you got TV, you got microwaves, and it goes up to infrared, visible, UV, X-rays, and then gamma rays. See, they're even more powerful. So that's what this is so interesting, that we're talking about a bubble, an energy field, an orb that can block out the most powerful energy frequency that we know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
You never heard this before, have you? Even though, you know.
No, I haven't. And actually, that leads me to my question. It's interesting because, like, I guess where I'm kind of thinking about now is, do you know when he did these tests with the gamma radiation, what did he use as, like, the gamma emitter?
I can't remember, but I think it was some kind of radioactive material, but I'm not.
Wondering, like, how much, like, gamma radiation was needed to be able to
I can't remember how he did that, but remember he invented the gamma ray transducer to measure that.
Oh, right.
And he also used radio waves and radioactivity and you know, all different kinds of frequencies that he could put within the pyramid to give off those energy fields, which then he could measure the attenuation, you know, how much got through the bubble,
right?
How much, what percent didn't.
So I guess he got exposed to a lot of radiation.
Yeah. And it did affect his house. And by the way, back in as far as 2005, NASA and scientists at the University of Kansas, they believed that hundreds of millions of years ago, a mass extinction on Earth could have been triggered by a star explosion producing a gamma ray burst. So, you know, I mean...
Yeah, so it's a...
That could have wiped out the dinosaurs, you know?
Yeah, and it kind of adds to the plausibility of the theory that, you know, the pyramids were built for some sort of protection.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I got so much I can talk about with Joe Parr's research, but don't you think just this much is a potential for incredible pyramid research? Scientifically, not... You know, wearing a pyramid hat.
Right.
And Joe's work also, he also showed that meditating under a pyramid is not always beneficial to your health. Depends on the time of year and location and other things. You will hear that anywhere.
Yeah.
So he would suggest, and the Russians, it depends. They didn't agree with that. The Ukrainians did. Supposedly, the energy field towards the top of the pyramid is very detrimental. When they were building the pyramids in Moscow, I don't think I mentioned this last week. My friends in Ukraine said that the workers would start to pass out and they'd have to bring them down to recover because of the energy fields. And my partner which has a spokesperson for the Russian research, denied that and said that's not true, that there's always been a beneficial effect where there's a conflict between Ukrainians and the Russians. Researchers that I worked with on that. So, again, like anything, more work needs to be done. And there's been no peer review in that research, and that bothers me, okay? So, But I was thinking all this time. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, when Joe Park, there's another effect, you know, when you get to high elevation, obviously the air thins out, but it depends how high the pyramid is. Did Joe Park say if he felt any of those effects when he went to the top of Giza?
Did it affect what? The height, you mean?
When Joe Parr... When Joe Parr was at... When he climbed, you know, to the top of Giza, did he feel any more faint or, like, any difference in...
No, I asked him that. I think because... Remember I said pyramids have a very low energy field around them unless they're activated. So would have had to activate the pyramid. What he did find is that... And I don't know, did we ever publish this? I don't think so. That the energy field and the electromagnetic field, the coming up the sides of the pyramid were stronger than any other place in the Great Pyramid. And nobody has come up with that finding. So the top of the pyramid, something very special about it. You know, was there a capstone there that's missing or was it never built? I asked Joe about that. And I can't remember his answer. When was... He thought he saw cement and stuff, so it's possible there was a capstone. And then I'm thinking, maybe he said there wasn't. So after 20 years of research and everything, you know, it's hard to. And I'm a terrible note taker. I never take a lot of notes. You know, I have a diary that I tried to put all my scientific notes in, And but I don't have everything in there, but it was just kind of stuff. So now in his lab, I don't want to run out of time here. I got another. Okay. So he noticed the bubble he created around the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the centrifuge, the small bubble?
Yeah.
After doing these experiments for 10 years or more, it started to expand and encompass his whole lab.
So was he knew it was a bubble because of the, he just, like, it wasn't a bubble he could see, right? It was a...
Right. You couldn't see it.
Right. It was like
you
an energy
pressure
bubble.
Difference. Yeah.
Right.
I think it was
but
about...
eventually he... So how did he learn that it was encompassing his lab? Because the readers, like, he would just step farther and farther back and, like, get in and out of the bubble?
He used the... He measured the pressure differential. I think it was about 4.5 pascals. That's the unit of measurement of pressure. And he found out okay. that the pressure in the lab was different. I think the bubble extended around a radius of 30 feet, which is pretty big. It actually overlapped in part of the house. And sometimes he felt the effect of it. But the funny thing is it was surrounding the lab where he was, which went outside the house.
Oh.
And it turned out his lab was totally sealed off, and honeybees were found in his lab on the table dying, and there's no way they could have gotten in. So he thinks they got into, like, hyperspace through an opening because of the bubble.
Huh.
And they were disoriented, and they died and had very similar symptoms of the colony collapse syndrome that everybody was researching years ago, and nobody really found out the cause of that. Have you heard of that colony collapse syndrome?
No, I haven't heard of that.
That was, about 10 years ago or more, that there was a decline in honeybee numbers. Nobody knew why. They were just dying, and they called it colony collapse syndrome or disorder. And possible causes included genetically modified crops, pathogens, pesticides, even electromagnetic radiation from cell phone towers. Then I think the final cause they thought of some kind of virus or bacteria, but it's still really not for sure. But Joe's actually, I remember telling Joe to have his daughter take it to the university there, honeybees, and have them tested by an entomologist. But it appeared like they were, like, disoriented, and then they eventually died. So I thought this was incredible because it could give us maybe an insight into colony collapse syndrome.
Yeah, definitely.
Amazing. All the stuff coming together, you know?
Yeah. That's very interesting. I don't know.
Well, he set up an audio oscillator at 20 cycles per second.
Okay.
Okay? And he ran it in his lab to see if this would cause more bees to come in.
And?
Why did he do that? That's the frequency of the honeybee's wings vibrate at, 200 cycles per second. See, this guy's brilliant, thought of it. Okay, so honeybees, you know, oscillate the wings of that. You can actually, I think, hear it. It's very low frequency. And so he set up an audio oscillator and to see if that would work. But it turned out, he said, both him and his wife became very disoriented with that thing running 24 hours a day, even though they really couldn't hear it. So it was causing some effect to the central nervous system or the brain. If you just play an audio frequency of 200 hertz, it will not cause a disorientation. But his lab with the orb and the frequency then produced the disorientation.
Okay.
So this pyramid energy field is doing incredible things. It's like, you know, causing... we got energy fields blocking off radiation. It's causing objects to move, you know, into walls. It's causing maybe bees or objects to move through a different dimension in space. You know, my interest is string theory, and it postulates, well, the earliest version postulates 10, then 11 extra dimensions, instead of the three spatial and time dimensions. So it added six more dimensions than seven to make the equations work. So, you know, physicists that believe in string theory believe there's other spatial dimensions, which we can't see or don't have access to. So this is not science fiction, you know?
A lot of this stuff is, you know, there's theories out there. It's just very hard to prove this stuff.
Yeah. So, time's almost over. That went so quick,
yeah,
didn't it? I can't believe it. I wasn't even looking at the time. Before I kind of sign off here, give me your brief, you know, reaction to this. I threw a lot at you, you know, really assuming the data is correct. Okay. Remember I said peer review, it has to be done. Maybe
right.
He made some errors. Maybe he measured some, maybe anomalies or artifacts. But if this is true, his data, what do you think of that?
I mean, it's interesting because it's hard for me to connect the centrifuge experiments with these grand, you know, physical structures that, you know, they're made of these bricks. And it's interesting that he put these model pyramids in, you know, centrifuge, got this energy bubble,
mm-hmm.
and all this crazy phenomena happened. And it's kind of like, well, you know, someone should continue that, right? Because it sounds repeatable, and it's something that is very, obviously centrifuge isn't cheap, but it's not like unknown things that only he knew how to make. It's cool.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it definitely should be continued if possible.
Well, you know, you would think in my 20 years of promoting, I don't say promoting this stuff, being a spokesperson, you would have gotten all kinds of universities, institutes, and places interested,
mm-hmm.
right? Nobody. So, well, anyway, Veronica, thank you again for a nice show and being with me and asking great questions. And I think you really helped out because a lot of this stuff got a little kind of complicated. So I want to thank Derek Ordet for permission to use his music for the intro, Chris DeSalvo for the ending theme, Marie Vargas, our producer, Rob, the owner of LiveParanormal.com Network, and my wonderful co-host, Lady Veronica DeSalvo, my daughter. And I want to thank you all for listening, and until next week, God bless you all.